watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the program, we're going to continue with a variety of international speakers on the subject of reaching what one of last week's speakers called a global grand bargain to confront the triple crisis: climate change, peak oil, and resource depletion. The speakers were part of a conference addressing those topics put on by the International Forum on Globalization in 2007. But first, I want to address an email from a listener that made me feel quite desperate, in that he asserted that climate change was a hoax perpetrated by global financial elites in order to put in place world government, and he chided me for propagating what he considered a lie. Then I heard another global warming is a hoax statement by the hosts of a financial podcast which has a far bigger audience than Unwelcome Guests has. The program Financial Sense at financialsense.com positions itself as an alternative to mainstream business journalism. The hosts, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler, are intelligent and thoughtful people. And though I couldn't disagree more with their ultra-capitalist politics, they and their guests accurately predicted the financial meltdown while the mainstream financial media were talking about the Goldilocks economy. In a portion of their weekly show, they answer questions that listeners have left on their taped message line. I'm going to begin by playing you their response to a listener who objected to their irresponsible climate change denying position. And you can hear the response, in which co-host John Loeffler asserts that there is a growing scientific consensus that the International Panel on Climate Change report was hysterically exaggerated. I'm going to follow that with a clip from a recent episode of Radio EcoShock, ecoshock.org, that talks about how climate scientists now realize that the IPCC report far understated the speed at which climate destabilization is occurring, and that the situation, they realize, has grown even more critical. I know what I believe, that climate change is real, and radical action is necessary to save our species and life on this planet. You'll have to decide who you believe. A comment for those who still think climate change is a hoax of some sort. By the time its effects are obvious to those who now deny it, it will be too late to act. Okay, first, John Loeffler of FinancialSense.com with the climate change denying position.
This next question ran 2 minutes, and we don't run two-minute questions here on the program, Jim, but I did want to address it so that the person who called in knows we are not dodging the issue. It came from Don in Arizona, and let me see if I can paraphrase what he said in the two-minute call. He doesn't agree with your statements about global warming, and I'm assuming that he assumes that global warming, now meaning anthropogenic global warming, meaning man-made, is a reality. And he likens it to the financial situation where you thought you would have a nice creamy filling in the middle, but instead it accelerated too fast and out of control. It accelerated because of feedback loops. And in this case, this would be a forward-looking positive feedback loop, which amplifies the effect rather than a retarding or negative feedback loop in the system. And he thinks the same thing would happen with global warming. So when should you address the issue such as this? If you wait too long, it's too late to fix. And valid arguments can be made on a scientific basis for this type of a situation, whereby if you don't deal with it early on, by the time the effects are really manifest, it's really far too late to do anything about it because the whole issue is cascading forward. Having said that, I have watched global warming since 1992 in the UNCED conference, the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development in Rio de Janeiro back in 1992. And I will say, as I've been watching it in the year 2008, the case for man-made anthropogenic global warming is either collapsing or having to undergo major modification. I'll give you just bullet items. And like I say, I always hate to cover this subject in a brief amount of time because it's a very big issue and you can't do it. And it always triggers off a flurry of emails. All right. Number one, the computer models are not panning out, especially in tropospheric measurements. Certain things that have been predicted to be happening are not happening. Number two, more and more scientists are jumping ship on the whole situation. The American Physical Society reversed its position in 2008. It's one of the largest organizations representing scientists in the world and said there is a real need for a robust debate on this because a substantial number of their members do not believe that anthropogenic global warming is a reality. There was just an abstract that I was reading, and I've been talking to this professor at Western Washington University, in which, here's the abstract from the American Geophysical Union. Solar influence on recurring global decadal climatic cycles recorded by glacial fluctuations, ice cores, sea surface temperatures, and historic measurements over the past millennium. And he is basically saying global warming? No. A global cooling forecast is backed by real science, given especially the downturn in solar index and other things that's going on in that area. So that's just an example. More and more scientists are jumping ship. Number three, there never really was a real consensus. If you remember Richard Loomis saying here a few weeks on the show, he really went around trying to find studies that had been done. And basically the last one that was done was somewhere around 2003, 2004. And it did not show that a majority of the scientists that were involved in climate research believed that anthropogenic global warming is a reality. There never was a consensus. Now, please, don't send me the Oreskes study, okay? The Oreskes study was cherry-picked, 900-plus studies out of a database of 12,000 on climate change. Lo and behold, in that very same database were abstracts that didn't agree with the consensus, but that somehow didn't make it into the Oreskes study. So the Oreskes study was a very flaky one. Not even on the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change do all of the people agree with the outcome. Very few, a minority, will only sign off on the total conclusions of the IPCC report. So that was it. There never really was a consensus. And that's the direction it is truly, truly going right now. You're watching that it either collapses a viable hypothesis or it's going to have to undergo severe revision, in which case it really isn't quite the crisis, the imminent immediate crisis that we are facing, that we have been told is going to fall upon the planet. The predictions that the IPCC made early on are simply not going to happen. They were drastic and almost at the level of hysteria.
That was John Loeffler of FinancialSense.com. Remember some of the claims he made about scientific opinion when you hear the following clip. This is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock, EcoShock.org, talking to David Spratt of Climate Code Red.
This is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock with an 11th hour warning about our planet. Climate negotiations have failed. World-renowned scientists are calling for swift action to save the world's atmosphere right now, before it's too late. David Spratt is co-author of the book Climate Code Red, The Case for Emergency Action. He's just sent out a rather frightening update, and we'll talk with him now from Australia. Hello, David.
Hi.
Well, we've just had a burst of cold and snow here in the Northern Hemisphere, and that always brings out the climate doubters, but the top scientists seem like near panic to me about this climate disruption. Can you tell us about the latest science and the prospect of global warming?
Well, I think what was interesting was that at Poznan a couple of weeks ago, there was a real push on by the scientists who, I think, really get the big picture. saying that it was really important for there to be a post-IPCC update early next year before Copenhagen, because the IPCC report, which is now 18 months old and its cut-off point for the research was another 2 years before that, so that report is essentially 3 to 4 years old and is now so conservative as to be dangerous. And that's what a number of people like Ken Caldera and James Hansen and so on are saying. What does that mean specifically? We know that human emissions are going up faster than the worst scenarios. We know the greenhouse gases in the air are now tracking at worse than the worst, the most pessimistic scenarios of the IPCC. And then we have what's happening in the Arctic over the last 2 or 3 years, which is not dealt with at all in the IPCC report, which actually changes everything. And that's where our book started.
And, you know, it's kind of fantastic because I'm in Canada and I know lots of people in the United States. We're near that Arctic meltdown, and yet it hasn't really penetrated to the public consciousness what it means. What are the scientists saying? I mean, it took a little time to get this data together, I guess, to really figure out what it does mean.
Well, I mean, it started to happen that the IPCC said that the Arctic floating ice, which is the ice that just sits on the sea, historically averages about 3 meters in thickness. It used to be an area of about 8 million square kilometres. I don't know whether that compares to Canada, but it's about the size of Australia. They thought with global warming, it would probably go towards the end of this century, in 100 years' time. What happened in September 2007, it actually dropped to half its usual size. It almost got there again in September 2008, even though the conditions were much cooler. So it's about half its size, but in addition, it's been thinning because about two-thirds of the heat that's been coming into the Arctic hasn't actually been coming directly from the sun. It's been coming from warmer currents, which is an indirect global warming effect. So you put those two together, thinning ice in a smaller area, and it means that in summer now, and it was certainly the case 3 months ago, that 80% by volume of the Arctic ice is now being lost in summer. And the predictions are, I think it could happen next year. Certainly within the next 10 years, we will have an Arctic that is ice-free in summer, and that has just huge, huge consequences for regional warming, for climate on the west coast of the United States, for the stability of the permafrost, particularly in Siberia. So as one climate scientist says, what starts in the Arctic doesn't stop in the Arctic, and that's the really big issue.
Well, another thing that's really bothering me is how, and you mentioned this in your update, that Western governments have found trillions of dollars all of a sudden to pay off bad bets by the banks and practically nothing to deal with climate change, the real big threat. Now, I know Barack Obama, he's appointed a great science advisor in John Holdren, but what else should Obama be looking at here?
Well, I've talked about climate in the ways dealt with at the international negotiations and by the national governments I've seen. I mean, we had a change of government here 12 months ago from a very conservative government to a centre government, and they've just brought out a carbon pollution reduction scheme plan, a carbon trading plan, which will actually mean that Australia will produce more CO2 in 2020 than it does now, which has appalled everybody. I think the problem is that governments, one, are not on top of the science. They're dealing with IPCC science. They don't know what's going on in the Arctic. They probably don't know what's... they don't want to know what's going on because it's more than inconvenient. Secondly, because of that, they're setting targets which are far too low. I mean, we've heard a lot of debate, even in Poznan, about the need for the Annex 1 countries, the advanced capitalist countries, to reduce their emissions by 25 to 40% by 2020 over 1990 levels. That's sort of the mantra. But that would produce temperature rises of 2.5 degrees, which would take us past several tipping points. It would probably flip the system to 4 or 5 degrees. So they're bad on targets. And I think the thing that we discovered most in writing the book is that governments want to see climate policy as something that you can negotiate or compromise about. I mean, they just see it as another political issue. We have a centralised wage-fixing system in Australia where you have essentially the unions on one side and the employers on the other, and you always have a compromise down the middle, a trade-off. And governments think that on climate that you can engage in compromise and trade-offs, and as I have been fond of saying recently in Australia, is they don't understand that you can't negotiate with the laws of physics and chemistry. It's a really dumb thing to do. So in terms of what Obama should do, I think, one, he should absolutely get a latest science update so he's got an evidence base for making decisions. He should be honest about that. He should be honest about that with the American people, because it's too late to pretend and live in fantasy land. Secondly, he's got to understand and talk about the conclusions that you draw from that. And the conclusions which James Hansen and many others are drawing is simply this: there is too much carbon in the air. Now, James Hansen says that to get the Arctic ice back, which we absolutely have to do, because if we don't, you get a 5-degree regional warming, because light reflective ice is replaced by dark heat-absorbing sea. That's happening already, which is why August temperatures in the Arctic this year were 5 degrees warmer than usual. We're already seeing that starting to happen. That will have two consequences. The first is that the ice sheet on Greenland, which is a 7-metre sea level rise, will melt. If there's no Arctic sea ice, Greenland will go. There is no way it can stay. And secondly, if you get that 5 degrees of regional warming plus a few other factors, you'll probably destabilize the permafrost, and there's double the amount of carbon in the permafrost in the air, and that would just be the end of the game for all of us. So I think he has to say, we have gone too far. There's too much up there. We have to reduce the amount of carbon in the air. We have to go for zero emissions. This is just, from a scientific point of view, non-negotiable, and then you can start talking about the money.
Well, you mentioned the new Kevin Rudd government in Australia, but that's something that makes me feel a little helpless on climate, because I've been saying to myself, well, once something terrible happens and it's obviously climate change, then people will demand action. And it did happen in Australia with that decade-long drought, and the public voted for climate action, and now the government can't or won't do it. There seems to be a stall. So if politics doesn't work, what then?
Well, I think the problem is that people wanted to believe that the government would do more than it could. There's a bloke called Ken Ward, who's Deputy Director of Greenpeace in America, who says that one of the great climate delusions, particularly from the large green organisations, is to believe that climate is about policy. He says it's about power. And we've seen that the same thing here, where the large green climate advocacy organisations cuddled up to the new government, was nice to them, gave them lots of policy options, didn't try and mobilise people, didn't put real pressure on members of parliament, and we've got the result we have. I think this requires a huge mobilisation of people. If we don't inflict serious pain on politicians, they simply won't move, because they are beholden to in Australia, in particular, the coal lobby, which is large and dominant in, obviously, North America, the oil lobby. We have to inflict political pain. I think the other thing, coming from the other side of politics, is there are more people in business in Australia, and I think around the world, than in government, who understand that there's no jobs and there's no profits on a dead planet. I mean, we have people here at the top of the business cycle who absolutely support us in our demand for zero emissions and the cooling of the planet and what we have called an emergency or war economy transition to a low-carbon future. And I think we need to mobilise them as well, because we know in the advanced Western countries that these governments will probably only change when business tells them to, because they run the show. And I think some effort should be put in that end as well, because it is certainly clear that business is well ahead of government in Australia. I mean, in terms of the question you asked before about money in banks, I mean, the mantra we've had all the time is, oh, look, we can't afford this. We can't afford this, we can't afford this. I mean, it was odd in Australia, because a report was done by McKinsey & Company for Australia, which I think was an offshoot of an international report they did. And for Australia, they showed that of all the emissions reductions, the first quarter, roughly, would be cost positive. That is, in the medium term, they would cost less then the savings. For example, you put hot water systems on household roofs, and the cost of that is less than the power bills that you save. So the first quarter would be cost positive. So it's always been delusionary for governments to say we can't afford this when it will save money. But I think the financial crash has shown that when there are bad bank managers who make bad and stupid decisions, the world can put trillions and trillions of dollars, I mean, it's probably, you know, going to end up being 10 trillion or something, into remedial measures. So for bad bank managers, we can find $10 trillion. When the planet is in peril, they can't find a cent. And that, I think, is now clear to people, and it's certainly clear to the people around Barack Obama who are talking about a Green New Deal. Whether, of course, they'll deliver is another question.
And I want to get back to the science for a minute, David. How credible are the new warnings about Arctic methane getting into the atmosphere?
Look, it's a bit early to tell. There was some very credible evidence given at the American Geophysical Union Conference in San Francisco last week, which is the largest gathering of climate scientists for the year. What they have detected is permafrost is permanently frozen ground. I mean, think of Siberia, think permafrost, the northern part of your country as well. There is also permanently frozen ground under the seabed. And what they're detecting is that some of that is melting, so you're getting methane bubbling up through seawater into the surface, which is disturbing. The reason for that probably is that you're getting much warmer currents up there, the sort of the warmer ocean fluxes that have melted most of the Arctic sea ice may be starting to destabilize some of that methane. What we don't know at the moment is how large the problem is presently, and what the trajectories would be. So there's no modelling of it. I mean, if a substantial amount of methane, either the land-based or the ocean-based methane, were to be warmed and to be mobilised, that would be the end of the planet as we know it for most people and most species. It is a very bad sign, but it hasn't been quantified enough yet for us to be able to say how bad, how soon.
Good enough. Well, another question that one listener asked me is, what is the climate carbon cycle? What does that mean?
Well, we have large amounts of carbon which are stored and exist in various parts of the biosphere. So the one we obviously know about is that there is carbon in the air. That's the smallest amount. There is carbon in the oceans. I mean, a cubic meter of water will hold 1,000 times apparently more water, more carbon than the same amount of air. So we have the air, we have the oceans, we have the soils. I mean, we have carbon obviously stored in the form of oil and carbon, but also organic material in soils and deeper down. And then we have the carbon which is stored in the living earth, in rainforests and trees and so on. So we have these banks of carbon, and obviously there is a circulation between them. When we burn coal or oil, we're liberating carbon from the ground and putting it into the atmosphere. There is a constant interchange between the atmosphere and the ocean year in, year out, where carbon is taken down and released. And so we can see this circulation of carbon between these various reservoirs. What's happening at the moment, of course, is that we're liberating carbon from the soil, also from living material with the destruction, particularly of rainforests in the Amazon and closer to us here in Australia, in Indonesia. And the destruction of rainforest, the trees are killed, they're burned, and the carbon pours into the air. So that's the carbon cycle.
Because I've read a paper recently called Climate Carbon Cycle Feedbacks by Andrew McIntosh and Oliver Wouldring. And one thing in it that I found really frightening was, it seemed to me they were saying, and you can correct me on this, but it seemed to me they were saying the probability of holding greenhouse gas levels at 550 parts per million was unlikely. And we might be heading towards 650 parts per million. Now, people like James...
Well, that's a dead planet.
That's a dead planet. And how can
that's
we debate whether to go there or not?
And that's a delusional debate. I mean, Sir Nicholas Byrne brought down a report two years ago for United Kingdom saying, look, we should aim for 450, but it's too difficult, so we'll try for 550. The implications of the policy that the Australian government has just brought down is probably 550 to 650. I mean, this is why I call the debate delusional, because these people do not connect these abstract numbers to real-lived impacts. And one of the problems we have is that as the Earth warms, we find, for example, that at less than 1 degree, we are warming the Arctic to the extent that the sea ice will go. The lack of sea ice will warm the Arctic region by 5 degrees, and that's going to be probably getting close towards enough of an increase to mobilise large amounts of permafrost carbon, which is a carbon cycle feedback. This is why we say we need emergency action. I mean, the notion that we can leave this to the market, put a price on carbon and stop runaway global warming, I think is another delusion. This is the greatest threat to mankind that we have ever experienced since we've been on this planet. I have no doubt of that. Sir Nicholas Stern said that the effects would be greater than the two 20th century great wars and the depression put together. That is really on the light side. I mean, we are now facing the extinction of most life on Earth, and that's why we say we need a whole of society mobilization. This is really serious. This is not just an issue. It is the issue. I think in some ways it's the only issue. I don't know why environment organizations from a macro point of view bother to campaign on anything else other than climate, because if we don't get the climate solutions, all the other issues will become irrelevant. And this requires the sort of mobilization that we see in wars. I mean, we know, for example, in the year after Pearl Harbor, that the United States economy was transformed from the largest producer of consumer goods in the world to the largest producer of military goods in 12 months. Now, being a large producer of military goods in itself is not a good thing, but it just shows that if you want to transform an economy, if you want to transform an energy system, you can do it, but you can't do it in what we would call politics as normal mode.
I think that's a transformative interview. I'm going to have to leave it there. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Our guest is David Spratt. He's the co-author of the book Climate Code Red, The Case for Emergency Action. It's published by Scribe Books in 2008. Be sure and visit his website at climatecodered.net.
Next, we'll continue with our series of speakers from the Confronting the Triple Crises Conference, held in September 2007 in Washington, and organized by the International Forum on Globalization, the IFG. Moderator John Cavanaugh will introduce the speakers.
Dr. Hermann Ott is head of the Berlin office of the Wuppertal Institute for Climate, Environment, and Energy. In the early part of this decade, he served with the policy planning of the German Foreign Office on Foreign Environmental Policy. He's the co-author of The Kyoto Protocol, International Climate Policy for the 21st Century, and also co-author of a book by the Wuppertal Institute called Fair Future, Limited Resources, and Global Justice. Please welcome Hermann Ott.
Thanks, John. Well, friends and colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, it's a real pleasure to be here. So we're talking about the grand bargain here. Climate policy is just one. Actually, it's not that long that I've discovered that climate policy is too narrow to actually cope with the problem of climate change. So what we have to do is to enlarge our notion of what climate policy really is. So I'm really grateful, for example, to Daphne, to remind me that the politics of the World Bank and the IMF and the International Development Banks are really important players, important blocks in this policy. I've also dealt much, much more than ever before with questions of technology, which I haven't done before, because I mean, I'm a lawyer, I'm a political scientist. So we're dealing with prescriptions, regulations, command and control. So what about technology? But technology is important, and some of the instruments that we use actually they don't really direct technology development in a specific direction, but they are like a broad antibioticum. They fight everything, they are good for everything, but if you, for example, want to push renewables, then you have to develop instruments like the feed-in law, for example, which has been developed by a stroke of a genius in Germany by a very conservative Bavarian parliamentarian and a not-so-conservative Green parliamentarian. That is a remarkable instrument. So you have to use specific instruments. But we are talking about climate policy now because, I mean, that's what I know most about. And secondly, as my previous speakers have already highlighted, it is one of the most important issues that we are facing. And Al Gore calls it a planetary emergency. The Commissioner Dimas, the Greek Commissioner of the European Union for Environment, has called it a global war on climate change, an expression which I don't like really because it implies some opponent which you can fight and we can't because it's within ourselves and our societies. But in any case, it is a situation that requires our attention, close attention and action, because if it goes on unfettered, it promises to delete all our advances that we've made in other fields, in social policy, in development policy, and so on. So that's why any agreement on climate policy is one of the cornerstones of any future global regime. A couple of months ago, I was asked by a German foundation to develop, to write a paper, and develop three scenarios. I did it because they asked me to. And only afterwards I discovered that these scenarios are really a very powerful tool. Three scenarios. One, which I called for myself at the beginning, the North Korean scenario. Second one, I called big business scenario. And the third one, I called the paradise scenario. I don't call them like that now, but you will soon discover why. North Korea, which is officially called business as usual. So we are not doing anything. The international negotiations fail because the U.S. is not integrating into the regime. In the global south, the leaders are relentlessly defending their own innocence. We haven't done anything. It's you, so you have to act. We have to develop first. Our people are hungry. There's no agreement on post-2012. The exploitation of our fossil fuel resources goes on unhindered. There is no movement. Our movement is unsuccessful in dealing with the mainstream consumerist kind of attitude. I mean, my own kids, it's difficult, actually, to counteract this kind of ideology which is imposed upon them by our media. They like big cars. They like shining cars. They like trademarks. They're all this kind of stuff. So our movement fails. Emissions rise. Why do I call it North Korea? Because it will lead to a society, to a global society, with a very, very small elite of affluent people, affluent in terms of finances, but also affluent in terms of emission rights. And it will lead to 99% of the global population, which is diminished. It's not the 6 or 9 billion. It's much less. It will lead to 99% of that population living in absolute poverty and misery. This sounds like science fiction, I know, but it could become reality. On the other side, we've got what I call the eco-fair scenario. Everything works out. The U.S. agrees to somehow be integrated into the regime. Developing countries' leaders are understanding. Yeah, of course, I know. You cannot do all at once, but we realize that you are good-willed. So there's an agreement. There is a post-2012 Kyoto II Treaty, or however you will call it. There is a rise in renewables, because as I said, I mean, the feed-in law was very successful. We had 18 gigawatts of wind energy increase in about 8 years. This is an amount of electricity that we could not have newly built with conventional power plants in Germany, because it's just extremely fast. And 15 countries around the world have copied our feed-in law. The Chinese didn't do it. It was stopped at the minister's level because the Chinese actually were afraid that it worked too well and they couldn't control it. So they introduced a quota system. So you can actually, with small money, and that's the kind of core of that idea, you can, with lots of people investing small amounts of money into renewable energy, you can achieve more than large corporations investing billions of dollars on their own. So it can be done. And under this scenario, it is being done. There are not only pockets of good life, but a movement for a different kind of life is spreading. Still, under this scenario, I must warn you, we're going to pass the 450 ppm, which is always quoted as being so important, and it is important. But even under these optimistic assumptions we're going to pass, they're going to peak somewhere at 470, 475 parts per million CO2 equivalents. But then emissions go down. So we're going to see major, major changes in our environment, in the global climate, but still, catastrophe might be averted. That's the best case. And then, in the middle, the second scenario, which I used to call big business, now I call it structurally conservative, because it sounds better, and it's not so offensive to certain parts of our society. And that's actually the biggest danger at the moment. I don't think that we're not going to do anything. Nah, we humans are stupid, but not that stupid. So we will at least give the appearance of doing something against climate change. Problem is, we're doing the wrong things at the wrong time. And the biggest danger, I think, of the US entering into the game is exactly that. Because I am confident that the US will be joining in after the next elections. But it depends on how. And that's the real issue. It's not whether we should act or not. I mean, this question is long gone. But the question is, what are we going to do? So under this scenario, there is partly a success of the international negotiations. It comes late, so the negotiations are not finalized in 2009. Agreement does not enter into force in 2013 as it should, but in 2014 or 15, which means the markets lose confidence, the global carbon markets, as they are called. We don't like them, but as Jennifer said before, they are able to generate a lot of money in a very short time. The biofuel hype has just shown it. There's just billions of dollars circling there, and if they see a good investment, they just go down and invest. It's the wrong thing. But if we would be able to divert these kinds of resources into the right, into wind energy, solar energy, then I think it could make a difference. But in this case, carbon markets break down. Even the EU misses its target. You know, it has a target of minus 20% in 2020, a unilateral target, but it fails that target. There are pockets of a different kind of life everywhere around the world, in China also, and in large parts of developing countries. But they don't become the prevalent mainstream kind of approach, which means emissions rise. Wrong kind of technologies are being used. Coal is replacing oil, the worst case scenario, because it's much more CO2 intensive which means more CO2 is released by burning a certain unit of coal than if you burn oil or gas. There's no structural change, and that characterizes this scenario. And I think that's why many of the business solutions that we are being presented are not only misleading, but they're actually dangerous, because they give us the impression that it could be a solution, but it's not. For example, there's not enough oil. Peak oil is one of our issues here. We've got enough gas. It was developed by Nazi Germany. It was actually refined by South Africa under the embargo of oil. So South Africa is now leading in the technology. And we can do it. Gasification of coal, coal to liquid, it's possible. And there's enough reserves down there. All with a promise of storage afterwards, clean coal. We just suck the carbon dioxide out of the exhaust and then bury it down there. But it doesn't work, or it may not work. Under the middle scenario, it works partly, because there may be certain geological formations where this actually works. But you can't do it on a large scale. And that's the promise that these energy companies actually make. We are building power plants now that can be retrofitted, and you'll be safe because there will be no CO2 emitted. And this is not true, and it's not possible with the present power stations, not even in Germany, where they're doing this. So technologies are coal, technologies are nuclear, technologies are big biofuels, big hydro, and no structural change, because that is the threat of renewables. These companies are not against renewables as such. I mean, they don't love coal. They don't love oil. It's just basically what they make the money with. So that's why they are defending the use of coal. But renewables are decentralized, and that's the problem, because they haven't got a monopoly there. Don't know what it's like in Germany, in the US exactly, but in Germany there's four large power companies who've got regional monopolies. And of course, if you've got hundreds of thousands of small investors in renewable energy, their profits are being endangered. And that's why they're against it. They're not so much against offshore on the sea, because they are much more like centralized solutions. So in this scenario, there is no changes to the structures, the basic underlying technological and economic structures of our societies, and that's why it's not successful. And it may actually, and that's the biggest danger, temperatures may rise above 2-3 degrees. So there might be a slip into the first scenario, into the business as usual, do nothing scenario. So what is important to avoid the second scenario and getting to the third? And that's the end of my presentation here. And I concur with what my previous speaker said, that it will depend on a deal being struck between traditional industrialized countries and the new elite, the new emerging powers, China, India, Brazil, South Africa, maybe Mexico, South Korea. And the way we can do it, there's only one. We cannot expect them to be more ethically responsible than us. We can expect them to be as responsible as we are, but not more. And so if you put all the arguments together, there's no way to get around the fact that the affluent North actually has the duty to support these countries in avoiding a fossil fuel development path. And that means we have to reduce emissions considerably, substantially. Minus 20 is actually not enough. We need minus 30 by 2020, and minus 80, minus 90 in 2050. And we have to make the resources available for them to actually leapfrog the fossil age. This will cost hundreds of billions of dollars. If you look at the ozone problem, it took $2 billion, actually, in the course of 10, 12 years that were diverted to developing countries in order to make them able to get rid of ozone-depleting substances. And if you take that times 100, at least. I think you will have the order of magnitude of what is required here. And we have to support developing countries, the weak developing countries, in adapting to climate change, because we are responsible for them. And without doing this, we will not only be ethically wrong, but we will also lose their support. And we need their support if we want to be successful. So these three ingredients, deep cuts in our countries and substantial support for activities to reduce emissions and to adapt to climate change, I think they are the way forward in the next 2 or 3 years. And we need that to get this Kyoto 2 agreement, post-2012 agreement, and get the society a little bit more on track away from the second scenario and towards the third eco-fair scenario. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Victor Minotti, who is the International Forum on Globalization's program director and has led its work on trade and has been a key component of this triple crisis work and its work on indigenous peoples. His work in this area was catalyzed after the Rio Earth Summit, where he traveled through South America to work with groups laying the groundwork for an international citizens network on economic integration issues. He was the researcher for the Earth Island Press book, The Case Against Free Trade, and coordinated the Clear Cut book project for the Foundation on Deep Ecology. Please welcome Victor Minotti.
Thank you, John. Thank you to everybody, all the organizers, Progressive Student Union, especially here at GW. And for everybody who traveled so far to join us for this important gathering. What I'm going to talk about is sort of picking up what a few have alluded to, and that's some of the other aspects of what's required in a global grand bargain. So far, we've heard mostly about what a climate regime needs to look like to deal with the threat of global warming. But a few people have alluded to, but I'll get into more about to really deal with the global, to have a global grand bargain that addresses the triple crisis, including not just climate change, but the end of cheap energy, the water, the fisheries, the biodiversity collapses. We really need to address the economic institutions because we know fundamentally that today the power is in the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund, and that if we don't address what's going on there and their rules and policies, then it's really limited what we're able to achieve through the United Nations. The basis of that bargain, so the basic point here is that a global grand bargain to resolve a triple crisis requires changing the global economic institutions. That needs to be part of the agenda. In fact, I think that is the agenda for a global grand bargain. The basis of that bargain must be built on one simple principle, and that is reversing today's hierarchy of values that puts profits above people and the planet. Let me say that again. Yeah? It's very simple, but I think that's what unifies our movement of movements. It's reversing today's hierarchy of values in the international system that puts profits above people and the planet. How do we do that? Well, let's first we look around and we use what already exists in the United Nations in terms of their existing universal rights to guide international exchange and commerce. By that I mean, how do we use the existing instruments of the UN Covenants on Human Rights, social, economic, and cultural rights, civil and political rights, the 100-plus International Labor Organization standards, the already existing Migrant Workers Convention, the Women's Declaration, the brand new Indigenous Peoples' Rights Declaration. All these things are universally agreed, already negotiated, driven by people's movements, not by corporations. These are our political demands. We've gotten our governments to the table, and we need to drive them forward and guide the way capital, technology, goods, services, and people cross border. That's where I think we go. The triple crisis, then, is the best opportunity we're ever going to have, or that we've had to date, to force that transformation of the international system and change that current hierarchy. Without it, I don't see how we ever de-link from the export economy. The numbers that Sarah Lorraine from Chile put up on the board this afternoon was the first time I'd ever seen it. It had always been in the back of my mind, but I'd never seen it laid out so clearly, how export performance and production is so directly linked to energy use. The more you export, the more energy you use. The reverse, we hope, is the more localized the economy, the less energy use. It's an essential part of any powering down agenda to relocalize the cycle of production and consumption. No way to do that until you address what's going on in the international system and the world trade rules that prevent you from being able to do that. It's these same world trade rules that make it illegal, in many cases, to ecologize your economy by internalizing ecological and social costs. I'll give you a couple examples in just a moment. But while we, I think, are trying to come around what unifies us in a global grand bargain, we have to recognize that our opposition, that is, the executives, the world's largest corporations, how they are already planning to use these same economic institutions to recognize what they already recognize are very much the same problems. They recognize climate change. They recognize water depletion and the end of cheap energy. But they see this primarily as a new license for more liberalization through these same economic institutions. What do I mean by that? For instance, it was referred a few times to one of the big impasses in the climate talks is transfer of technology. We know there are a lot of folks in the global south who still live on the land, indigenous peoples, peasant villages, small farmers. They want more than anything rights to their water, their land, their seeds, and to be able to stay on that land and live sustainably as they have for years. That needs to be a big part of our agendas as we fight against the triple crisis. But at the same time, there's a big move to the cities, there's a big lack of access to energy, and there is a real need for the transfer and the financing of clean energy technology. One of the big things that prohibits that right now is the World Trade Organization agreement that basically globalized the U.S. patent system and is called the TRIPS agreement, the Trade-Related Intellectual Property Rights Agreement of the WTO. If a country wants to import it, they have it to transfer a certain clean energy technology, they will either be prevented from doing that or they'll have to pay a higher price to the holder of that monopoly patent. Where are most of these patents located? Primarily in the north, the U.S., Europe, Japan. I don't see how we get past this whole question of expediting and financing and making cheap and affordable so many of these new clean technologies coming out. Unless we deal with the patent system. And we have a particular responsibility here. We can build on the successes that's happened already with the access to essential medicines fight, with HIV, AIDS, and TB. The campaign groups, Doctors Without Borders, many other groups fought for the last 2 or 3 years, maybe 4 or 5 years, and they got flexibilities and waivers and exceptions in these agreements to allow the countries, especially the poor countries, who have tens of thousands of people dying from HIV/AIDS and can't afford the access to those essential medicines that Pfizer and the other big pharmaceutical companies own and protect through these patent systems. Through a global campaign, they got waivers in these things, and now those countries are able to import those generic forms and cheaper forms of these different essential medicines. We need to apply that same principle, I think, to clean energy technologies. Probably the most important thing that the U.S. could do to cut its emissions is increase our automobile efficiency standards, CAFE standards. Not many people know that over 10 years ago, the European auto exporters challenged through the trading system these CAFE standards, and they won. The CAFE standards were found to be discriminatory against car companies that produce primarily more polluting cars. It's not clear to me exactly what happened, but I called the International Trade Council to the Senate Finance Committee, whose job it is to oversee that all U.S. law conforms with World Trade Organization law, And she said, what challenge? She didn't know about it. So it's not clear to me if the new proposal for stronger CAFE standards in this country conforms to this WTO ruling and if we're about to see possibly the triggering another challenge. There's a number of other things in the WTO agenda that really restrain what not just the United States but all countries need to do to be able to protect climate and pursue their own domestic and local energy systems. Let me then talk about what we do in terms of replacing this. What's our alternative agenda? What's our offensive here? Well, again, leaping from the WTO, right now it's not clear which is more powerful, the WTO or the United Nations multilateral environmental agreements. We've seen cases already where the WTO rules are chilling or are beating down efforts by countries to deal with climate. For instance, we saw just earlier this year the European Union's environment minister and industry minister came together and said, we want to have a border tax against countries that haven't adopted the Kyoto Protocol. The French prime minister ran on this platform. It was seen to be a very popular idea in Europe until their trade minister came out and said, nope, can't do it, would violate the World Trade Organization rules, never got off the ground. So what we're facing here is two international systems, one with the corporate rights of the WTO and another one, the multilateral environmental agreements and all the other universal rights that I talked about. The fight here is which one is going to be more powerful. We need to elevate these multilateral environmental agreements above the World Trade Organization and unify them under a consolidated, I think, United Nations Environment Organization that's more strongly capacitated to enforce them and to facilitate their implementation, and with a clear hierarchy of values that these will be superior to the corporate rights in the WTO. Also central, Also central to that is advancing human rights, as the Indigenous Peoples' Rights Declaration is. It's a human rights instrument. But has anybody, I think we need to do a calculation of how much carbon would continue to be sequestered, how much fresh water would continue to be protected into an aquifer and rivers and purification systems, how much biodiversity would be protected if Indigenous peoples were given land rights to their traditional territories. That's where the stuff is located. So fighting this triple crisis is also fighting for Indigenous rights, and moving forward with the implementation of this declaration is going to be key in this struggle against the triple crisis. I'll jump forward just by referring you to the document that's a working draft of the Global Grand Bargain. I believe it's available there. If not, there's the workshop tomorrow morning at 11:30 that proposes how we can replace the World Trade Organization with a new set of energy trade rules, things that allow flexibility for transfer of technologies, things that allow countries to set their own energy efficiency and renewable fuel standards, which currently it's not clear that they can. Things that allow, well, I'll refer you to that document. It's all quite detailed there, more than I have time to go in right now. But also to highlight again the transfer of technology, because a big question here is how do we raise the revenue to finance the transfer of technology? We know the people who invented these patents and the investors in them will expect to get paid in some way, or in many cases, those things won't get developed, let alone deployed. Where does that money come from? Well, I think as a movement, we need to put our collective brains together and think about all the different revenue-raising ideas that have been floated around the past few years and bring them together. Perhaps most powerful could be the idea of the speculative currency tax, what some people call the Tobin tax. It's almost fallen off of our agenda. Let's remind ourselves, I was talking to Susan George here from Attac France, that in July 2001, when the Genoa G8 summit happened, the French prime minister had adopted the idea of a Tobin tax and was taking it to the G8 to propose it as a G8 position that they would move forward to their finance ministers. September 11th happened a couple months later. It was off the front page. It's been off our political agenda ever since. We need to bring these sort of things back because not only do we need to raise the revenue to deal with the transfer of resources from north to south, but we really need to deal with speculative investment and the whole global financial casino.